Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand, this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Good evening and happy Shabbat to one and all. It's my pleasure to be with you. We have Kirk and JB here. And this will be a significantly more pleasant show and topic than what we endured last week. But I do have good news, and that is that I have been informed the website, Facebook site that we were exposing, condemning, distancing ourselves from, no longer exists. That the site is down, and that everything that has been posted there over the years is no longer exists. I don't know what they will do. I guess they can always form a new site. As I understand it, there's really only half a dozen active spell bots left on the as part of the original group, and they are deeply mired in conspiracy. They are, and because of the fact that we exposed them and would no longer speak of them on this program, they have gone. Just before they were taken down, they decided that they would turn their animosity not only on me, but on the books that I have written and what I've shared with everyone. And so they no longer consider anything that I've written or said to be valuable. So that's good, that they will no longer be citing their poison in Yahweh's name or in any way associated with anything, any of the translations that I have provided. So as I shared that with you just briefly, JB, prior to the program, you actually had something that they might identify with, something that they might feel a kinship with going forward. That was Scientology, right?
Actually, I think that was Kirk said that.
Oh, no. Oh, it's Kirk. You can always find a home in Scientology.
Yeah, that's right.
They have to watch it now.
Yeah, in fact, I've seen a couple of shows on Scientology.
I thought of that as you talked last week.
Their approach, particularly the way they treat those who have the courage to expose them. Very similar to Scientology. It could find a very accommodating home for their wild ideas in Scientology. But the good news is that a number of people stood up against them, two women in particular. A third was immediately benefited from them. They've lost virtually all of their membership and participants, and they no longer exist. So,
hallelujah.
Yeah, it was worth the effort. We're going to return to where we were then 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago. We were in what is the eighth volume of Observations for Our Time. It is posted on your site, iowabarrette.com, is it not, JB?
Yes, it is.
So for those who would like to follow along in the translations, you will find it there. We're picking up in First Chronicles, which is Dabriha Yoman, which means words of the time, words for the time. First Chronicles 29:23. Typically, Chronicles and Samuel cover the same period, many times the same conversation. And I guess I picked to translate what we're going to do now from Chronicles just for a little variety's sake, as opposed to just staying 100% in Samuel. But if there is something important and they both cover the same thing, my experience is that you're a lot better off relying on Samuel versus on Chronicles. Now, why do you think that might be, guys?
He's the southern kingdom, and the other is the northern kingdom, mostly.
No, Chronicles
Samuel is actually a nabby.
Well, he was a nabby, yeah, of course, yeah.
Yeah. Samuel was directly inspired by Yahweh, received direct communications from Yahweh. We don't know who wrote Chronicles, but we know who provided the book of Samuel, and that was someone whom God inspired directly and that God had conversations with. So that would sit well. Number two, the likelihood is that Words for Our Time is hearsay, where Samuel was an eyewitness to these events.
Mm-hmm.
The third reason is that we have almost nothing from Chronicles and the Dead Sea Scrolls. There's a tiny, tiny part of one chapter. I think it's like four or five verses from one chapter. That's all that exists in the Qumran collection. And even then, the first verse is like three words. The second is like four words. And the next two verses are seven or eight words combined. So you don't have enough of it to be able to verify it. Right. And with Samuel, there's tremendous amounts of Samuel that are available through the Qumran scrolls. That's not to say that that Chronicles doesn't have value. Sometimes it covers material that Samuel does not cover. But there are places where they disagree. For example, the name of the Yabusi that owned the threshing floor that Dod purchased to that became the Temple Mount. Different name in Samuel versus Chronicles. And the price paid for that threshing floor is different in Chronicles than it is in Samuel. So my view is that while the name of the Yabusi and the amount paid are insignificant in terms of our understanding, when there is a discrepancy like that, the most reasonable thing to do is to trust the eyewitness.
Yeah.
So I would say that's how I would resolve things like that. All right, we pick up on 1 Chronicles 29:23, recognizing that Samuel, for example, there's one and two, but yet in the Dead Sea Scrolls and in the original material, there's only Chronicles. There is not broken into two separate books. It's one of the things that people have, this tendency to say, well, there's this many books in the Bible. Well, no, that's not true. First of all, there's from Yahweh's point of view, there is no New Testament, nothing there, so you'd have to discount all of that. And then even in what is called the Old Testament, from Yahweh's point of view, it's the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. The number of books is significantly smaller than the number that is presented because things were not divided into two. But here is what we read. It says, and so then Solomon. Now, Solomon's name is interesting. It's based on shalom, and it means to reconcile. Recited on the throne, the seat of honor of Yahweh as king. succeeding Dode, his father. And he was successful and prospered. All Yisrael listened to him. Now, that's kind of an interesting thing here. Only really acknowledges, chose two kings, Dode and Solomon. From that point on, before that with Shaul, and from that point on, men chose their kings. Now, there's only two kings that ruled over a united Yisrael, because after Solomon, the northern kingdom split away and was very soon thereafter destroyed. And so there's only two that ruled over, had authority over all of Yisrael, and those were the two that Yahweh appointed. And it's called here the seat of honor or the throne of Yahweh. Yahweh doesn't mention any other king or any other place where he has the seat of honor. It's just Yisrael. So when you speak of a divine right to rule, two men had it, and they had it in one place. One followed the other, Dode and Solomon. And Solomon would not have had it had it not been for his father, Dode. There really is only one example of something that Solomon did that earned Yahweh's favor. When Yahweh asked Solomon, "What do you want?" And rather than the typical answer, you know, "I want power. I want great victories in battle. I want a long life. I want great wealth. I want lots of pretty women in my harem." You know, the typical stuff that that men have a tendency
to want.
Yeah, he just says, I want understanding. That's what I want. I want understanding. I want, when it comes to knowing what's important and making decisions that are right, fair, correct, I want understanding. And based upon him saying that, yeah, I said, well, because you did not ask for the things that, that most kings would request, and you said, I want understanding, you shall not only have understanding, but all of the other things that kings typically request, because that's the right answer. So when we, you know, so many people, particularly Christians, will say, I'm seeking God's will for my life. God presents what his will is. That's why when Yosha in the exemplar conversation with Yahweh said, thy will be done. Well, that means that it needs to be known. But God says, you know, if you want to really please me, ask for the one thing that's most important, understanding. Because with understanding, everything else falls into place. So the reason that all Yisrael listened to Solomon was because Solomon had understanding. There's lots of people that know stuff. There's lots of people that have power and influence for one way or another, but there's nothing more important to listen to or consider than understanding. So it's lots of people can, for example, there are people that are trained to recite the entire Quran from beginning to end. They can say, they can tell you every word, every chapter, every verse. Don't understand it, but they can recite it. I don't think there's anybody that understands the Quran better than I do. And understand that it was Muhammad's situational scriptures to satiate his personal lust for sex, power, and money. And that he and his God were one, and that he modeled his divine persona after Satan. That's understanding. Understanding has vastly more value than does knowledge. Right. Typically, you have to have knowledge for understanding. But if knowledge does not result in understanding, then typically you're what the world would call a scholar. And I think that's a huge problem today. Not enough people understand. That's why we were, Roy and I exchanged an email today, and we're talking about the failure of people to be to exercise their nesama and to engage in critical thinking. Well, it doesn't matter what you know. If you can't engage in critical thinking, if you can't be judgmental, if you don't understand, it doesn't do you any good.
Yeah, all the facts in the world do no good if you can't connect the dots.
That is correct. In fact, they can be of harm because they can confuse you. If you, particularly when you don't know how to distinguish between what's right and wrong, good and bad. And Yahweh exalted, elevated the merit of, reared and raised, nurtured and promoted growth in Solomon tremendously in the sight of all Yisrael, and bestowed on him a realm with a majestic appearance, which had not existed with any sovereign leader before him in Israel. Now, this if Hebrew was as I have read it, and it had a past tense, that wouldn't be much of a statement, because how many leaders had there been in Israel prior to Solomon?
Two.
Yes, two. Shaul and David. So that would not be saying much. But because Hebrew is infinite in time, liberated in time, it is also true that no one, after him, was no solvent leader in Israel after him was so blessed by Yahweh. So there is a contrast here that's really interesting, too. You look at Dod and Solomon. They chose to ask Yahweh for or express their understanding of his Torah. And with the case of Shaul, he tried to impose his own Torah, his own teaching, his own guidance. And Dod and Solomon were raised in such a way that they were magnified by Yahweh. He said, you know, if you listen to what I have to say, if you act as my children, if you seek understanding, I want you to know that this is the way that I'm going to bless your life. I'm going to enrich you. I'm going to empower you. And if
you're
time,
I said, Shabur, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And if you're going to be like Shaul, you're going to die.
Hmm.
So that's the story that is being told here. So Dod, and this is really interesting. So Dod, we get right back to him because Solomon's there because of his father. So Dod, the son of Yesi, the one who exists, it's Ben Yeshi, he who exists, stands, and is substantial, reigned over all Yisrael. The days he reigned over Yisrael were 40 years. In Chibron, which means to associate and form an association, he reigned 7 years. And in Jerusalem, he reigned 33 years. What do you think it was, 40, 7, and 33?
40 is the, well, 7 is the promise, 40 is for, what am I trying to say, reconciling?
Period of testing.
A period of testing. So he was tested, trying to be a king to a people that are quite rebellious for 40 years. 40 is important because Yah's equation for time is divided into periods of 40 yobel. The yobel are essential, as we know, because in a yobel year, which is every 50 years, is a yobel year, all debts are forgiven. All slaves are free. So all people are liberated, all debts are forgiven, and the land returns to you. And so we start anew, afresh. And so if you multiply 40 times 50, that's 2,000. So you have 2,000 years from the time that Adam and Chawa were booted out of the Garden of Eden for failing not only to listen to Yahweh, but rejecting, rather than acting on what Yahweh said, acting on what Hasatan had said, corrupting Yahweh's testimony. And 40 Yobel from that time, 3968 BC is 1968 BCE. What happened in 1968 BCE that might be important in resolving that problem?
Abraham.
Yeah. Abraham and his son, Yishak, went to Mount Moriah, and there they, along with Yahweh and Yosha, enacted Pesach Passover. And when they did so, Yahweh said that by so doing and by Abraham following Yahweh's instructions, Yahweh said, then the covenant is confirmed. And so the covenant was...
You know, a lot of people want to know why he had to do that, just to prove that he was trusted Yahweh, when we know he walked up the hill knowing he trusted Yahweh. But I was thinking about that, and it seems to me that he would have to do that to have that great contrast between here is man's approach by killing, sacrificing a child, their own, versus God's approach by him delivering the ram.
Right.
So you don't get to play if they don't do that. You don't get that teaching moment.
That's exactly what it was, a teaching moment.
Yahweh called it a test. And he said...
Oh, no, I know, but it seems even deeper than that.
With
all that information you brought about everybody that kills their children.
Yeah, it was really interesting, of course, that I went and surveyed every civilization around that time, before that time, and after that time. And all of them were into human sacrifice, particularly sacrificing children to appreciate their gods. And so wanted to say, that's not how we're going to do it here. And so is Yahweh providing the lamb for Passover, for Pesach, and providing it himself was the answer. But it was important. And this is what the faithful, particularly Christians, miss, because they want their salvation to be a gift and based on faith, and there's nothing to do. That's not the way that Yahweh sees it. Yahweh sees it as I've given you instructions, and if you don't follow those instructions, understand the instructions and follow those instructions, you don't get the benefit. It's just like the Noah and the ark. Noah could have been spectacular at listening to what God said about the ark. But what if he didn't engage and follow those instructions?
He would have been drowned like the rest.
That is exactly right. What if
I was actually Abraham writing something about that today. I was writing something today, and I was writing about the imperative mood. And I was talking about, the imperative. Yeah, it's just that. It's an imperative. It's something that must be done in order to achieve a goal. Yeah, and that's the caveat. It's not that it has to be done. You can choose not to do it. But if you want the desired goal, this must be done. And that's the imperative
mood. But it's the imperative mood, essentially 99.9% of the time that it's used in Hebrew, conveys volition. So if you want the benefit, this is what you need to choose. So it's still
you're free to not choose it, but if you want that benefit, it is imperative that you do this.
It's imperative that you choose it.
Yeah.
Yes. But the imperative mood is less about what we would consider it as an imperative in English. In fact, I think that's really even a poor choice of words for it. because an imperative is thought to be a command. And yet, when you really study Hebrew grammar and you look at where it is used, the imperative mood is almost never a command.
No.
It's about 1% of the time that it is a command.
I can't think of any instance off the top of my head.
Yeah, and it's 99% of the time conveys second person volition.
A necessary action that must be chosen to achieve a goal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're free to choose whatever you want, but this is the choice that you need to make if you want the desired, the stated effect. So, we have Abraham and Yitzhak choosing of their own volition to do, to act upon, to engage based on the instructions that Yahweh provided. Had they not done so, they would not have received the benefit of the covenant. So, that happened in 1968 BCE. Exactly 40 Yobel after that date, in exactly the same place, Yosha, as the corporeal and diminished manifestation of Yahweh, fulfilled Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim on Mount Moriah for exactly the same reason. It's one thing to accept the covenant and act upon its instructive conditions, which Abraham did, but Yahweh, just as he, in 1968 BCE, just as he provided the sacrificial lamb, and that sacrificial lamb is Yosha, he actually had to honor that promise. He had to provide for that benefit. And that's the reason why you find out in 1968 BCE, 2,000 years from that time is 33 CE, that's year 4,000 Yon. That's the time that Yahweh fulfilled the first four Mikre, enabling the benefits of the covenant.
Yeah.
And what is 2,000 years or 40 Yobel from 33 CE?
Yom Kippurim.
You betcha. Well, Yom Kippurim will be it's year 6,000 Yah in 33 CE is year 6,000 Yah. 40 Yobel exactly from 33 CE on their pagan calendar. And that's when will return, and he will return on Yom Kippurim, the Day of Reconciliations, and then set up a 1,000-year reenactment of what we witnessed in the Garden of Eden between 6,000 and 7,000 Yah. And should anyone be curious as to whether Christians have this right and that he's going to come back, be the second coming of Jesus Christ. Not only is there no Jesus and there is no Christ, he's not even coming back under the name Yosha. In fact, in Jeremiah 23, he says, they're going to declare, and what they're going to say upon my return is Yahweh Sadak. Yahweh's right.
He's not even coming back to Dallas, is he?
No.
To the home of the Southern Baptist.
Not coming back to Texas or to the most certainly won't be there in the Vatican. He's coming back to Jerusalem. So that's the
only place that really matters.
Yeah, that's why we have 40. And the reason we have 33 is that there are so many prophecies. In fact, I've been writing two chapters on Shemak, which is either translated source of growth or branch. A branch is a far more prevalent title for Yosha than is Masiach. In fact, Masiach is never used as a title, but branch is, and Shemak. And I've been going through those prophecies, and what you find is that almost all prophecies related to Dode that speak of the Shemak branch are true of both Dode and of Yosha, and that Dode and Yosha are considered quite similar. You know, it's amazing how we've turned one into the god of a replacement god of a new religion, and the other is only considered because, well, Michelangelo crafted a really nice statue of him, and that you know, he's famous for throwing a rock at a giant. But from Yahweh's point of view, I dare say that Dodes more important than Yosha. And all of those prophecies, those two are presented with an equivalency. And so when we're told that Dode reigned in Jerusalem for 33 years, how long did Yosha live during
lived 33.
I didn't believe that would be 33 years.
Right, 33 years. Exactly. So that is just another one of those subtle insights that if you want to understand Yosha, you better understand Dode. That the analyst said, you know, Dode, he is my beloved son. I am his father. And, you know, Yosha walked out of the pages of the Torah. He was a living manifestation of the Torah. He fulfilled Yahweh's Torah promises. But how would you know that if you didn't know how to observe the Torah? If you didn't know that the purpose of the Torah was to make us Yahweh's sons and daughters? The purpose of the life of Dode is to reveal how to observe the Torah, how to understand its covenant, understand the purpose of the covenant is to make us beloved children of Yahweh. But even more importantly, while Yosha was unlike us and perfect in his being an exemplar of the Torah, Dode was like us and imperfect. And so the example that is more relevant for us is the man who was imperfect, but yet Yahweh said, he is tzedak, he is right, he is correct, he is vindicated, because that's the whole purpose, not only of the Torah, but of Yosha's sacrifice. So we can be like Dode. We can't be like Yosha. You know, so many times Christians will say, well, we should follow Jesus' example. They haven't got a clue what his name was, and they haven't got a clue what his example was.
But he's more
observant than they're.
Yeah,
they're
good. Be Torah observant.
Yeah, but the fact is, we can't. We're incapable of following his example. We just flat are incapable of it. We are capable of being like Dode. Now, that's not to say that we go out and we have a harem. That's not to say we go off and do some silly stuff, engage in battles and the like. That's not the part of the example that matters. Part of the example of Dode that we can't implement, is to study the Torah, to come to understand it, to speak about it, to write about it. We can do all of those things.
Mm-hmm.
We can study the Torah. We can come to understand the Torah. We can capitalize on the Torah. We can engage in the covenant. And we can share what we learn. We can do all the things that caused Yahweh to care so much about Dode. So those three numbers, Chebron for 7 years, Jerusalem for 33, and a total of 40, are all essential in conveying Yahweh's ultimate timeline. So when Yahweh provides dates, they're important. You need to.
I would dare say you could explain Yosha better because of Dode than anybody else on the face of the earth ever.
Well,
because of what he wrote.
Give you a great example. Where can we read an eyewitness account of what happened in on Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim in year 4000 Yah, 33 CE on the Roman pagan calendar? Who wrote
Psalm 22.
Provided us with the only eyewitness account of what happened on those
Psalm
22.
Days.
And 88. Yeah. Who was the author who wrote Psalm 22 and 88?
Dode.
Absolutely.
How do you know how to even understand the Torah without what Dode wrote?
Well, that's
we can get a glimpse of it, but he laid it out there, you know, in couplets, not couplets, but
When Yosha said that not a single yod or tittle, that the smallest letter, the yod, the first letter in his name and Yahweh's name, and the tittle is the strokes that comprise the other letters, not a single stroke, not even the smallest letter, will be done away with until the entire Torah and prophets are fulfilled. When he said that, is there anything that was written that presents the way to observe and come to understand the Torah in alphabetical order, writing 8 statements about each of the 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet? Does anything come to mind that might be the literal fulfillment of that?
Yeah.
Psalm 119.
No. Yeah, Psalm 119, right. Mizmor, Psalm 119. Yeah, I'm so much now into Hebrew. I say Psalm, I say, what's that? You know, it's one of the advantages, if you do this enough, you actually start to think in Hebrew. But the lyrics of the 119th Mizmor is specifically what he was talking about. So, yeah, that's my view. The reason that there's an equivalency and a prioritization from Yahweh's point of view between Dod and Yosha is that Dod's more important to us. He is the one that provides us the insights, knowledge, and understanding that we need to be effective in our understanding of what the Torah is, what it represents, what it is offering through the covenant, and how to capitalize upon it. It's all through Dod. And then, you know, so many people, when I say, listen, there's God doesn't have a New Testament, and they'll say, well, then how would you know what even if you come up with the right name, what Jesus did? Read the 22nd and 88th.
You fulfill Passover. We know what Passover is. We got Abraham.
Right. Yeah, read the Torah, and you know what Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim are and what had to transpire. You know, read the story of Abraham on Yahweh providing the Passover lamb on Mount Moriah to honor the terms and conditions of the covenant. You know, it's not hard.
And that's one of the stupidest billboards I've ever seen for a church. Said, "Want to know God? Know His Son." I'm like, "Yeah, I'm sorry, you can't possibly understand Yahusha if you don't already know Yahweh."
Correct.
The opposite.
That is correct. Yes, the opposite is true. Yeah, and knowing the Son is only relevant if you know which Son you should know. And the Son to know is Dod. Yeah, it was really clear. Dod, He is my beloved Son, and I am His Father. Now, when it comes to Yahweh, no matter what we do, so long as we're in a relationship with Him, He can make bad good. Great example is the 91st Mizmor. The 91st Mizmor is the reason we should not speak favorably of our military. Anybody that says, you know, your military is providing your freedom. No, it's not. You know, it gives you all the rights that you have. No. The 91st Psalm says that Yahweh is our protection. If we're engaged doing what Yahweh wants done, He is our protection. And Dod recognized that. Guess who didn't?
Shaul.
It's Shaul. He did not recognize it. So when Shaul, King Saul, was out rebelling against Yahweh, doing what Satan did, in other words, doing what the rabbis did, adding to what God had said, adding his own spin on it, he put himself in harm's way, and he had no protection. Those of us who are part of the covenant realize that, you know, there's no reason for us to be concerned about the fear-mongers promoting conspiracies. Why? It's irrelevant to us. So, King Saul was an example when a life is lived in an ill-advised way relative to the Torah, and it can end badly and be deadly. So, While the following is not an uplifting or edifying story, it is nonetheless critical that we appreciate the fact that God's not to be trifled with. No matter how good, no matter how popular or powerful, no matter how well-connected or courageous, apart from Yahweh, everybody dies. Remember, Yahweh said, you know, there wasn't anybody considered more appropriate from a human point of view to rule than King Shaul. But Yahweh said, by choosing him, you're rebelling against me. So no one in all of human history manifested a higher degree of the aforementioned attributes than King Shaul. But having chosen to negate and augment aspects of the Torah to suit his own ambitions, he and his sons went from annoying to adversarial. And because the people foolishly respected and faithfully followed these leaders, they suffered the same fate. They lost their freedom, they lost their possessions, they lost their lives. So this is the tragic tale. It's told in the 10th chapter of 1 Chronicles. It begins, "And the Philistines," the Pelishtei. Pelishtei means illegitimate and adversarial foreign foes who terrorize. Now, what is the Muslims in Israel, what do they refer to themselves as?
They love to be sort of
Palestinians.
Palestinians, right. And where there's only one place in the world, in all of human history, that you will find the basis for Palestinian. And where is that?
That was in
the Torah. Right here,
yes,
where we're looking.
Right here. Yeah. You find it in the Torah and the prophets, and they are the Palestinians, is the actual name. So from God's point of view, the Palestinians, now Yisrael means individuals who engage and endure with God. What does Palestinians mean? And why would you call
illegitimate
yourself,
and adversarial foreign
adversarial
who terrorize.
Right. So foreign, well, that means that the land is not theirs.
Not theirs. Right.
Foe means they're adversarial to God. Illegitimate means that they have no claim on Yisrael.
No.
And then what's the other aspect of Philistine?
They terrorize.
Terrorize.
Right.
Well, you know, I think that means we've been wrong all these years because we've said it's wrong to call them Palestinians. Apparently, that's the perfect term for them.
Oh, it is. It's a
Amalekite says
well,
too.
Yeah, it is a perfect term if you understand the term. They, of course, chose it because the Romans in 133 to 135 CE, when Hadrian followed through on his threat to turn Yisrael and Jerusalem into a playground for the Roman legions and to build a temple honoring himself on the Temple Mount. As part of that, when the Jews rebelled, you've got, the Romans, once they defeat the Jews for the second time, saying, you know, even though this has been for the entire time that the Greeks controlled it, for the entire time that we, the Romans, controlled it, has been the province of Yehuda. We're going to rename the place now that we have salted the earth and tore everything down and killed hundreds of thousands of people and hauled others into to slavery and started this diaspora where we have taken the native people, those that survived our onslaught, and dispersed them as slaves throughout the Roman Empire. We're going to rename the place after the most vicious, the most disgusting foe listed in the Torah and Prophets, after the Philistine. And so that name, which is honored by scholars, because a scholar is someone who knows but does not understand, has been usurped by Muslims saying, yeah, well, we're you know, that's the place the scholars call it Palestine, so that must be, we must be Palestinians. Now, these the Philistine, which is, of course, only known to us from the Torah and the prophets, what happened to them? What happened to them?
The Assyrians wiped them out.
Yeah, the Assyrians wiped them out to the last. There.
Yeah.
And
there no
was there any trace of them? Did they have a written language?
No, they, like Muhammad, couldn't read and write and left nothing.
Yeah. Right, they left nothing. They didn't build anything. They didn't create anything.
No culture.
They left nothing. All they were is illegitimate terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
Adversarial, illegitimate, foreign terrorists. And so to pretend that there's a group of people called Palestinians, you have to be brain dead. You have to be ignorant. You have to be irrational. And so to even speak of them says that you have no understanding, and you have no desire to understand, because there are no such people. There were, but they ceased to exist 2,500 years ago. So this says, and the Philistines, the Philisti, attacked, fighting, Lacom, deployed their military, engaging in battle in opposition, attempting to conquer and control, waging war against Israel. And the people of Israel were driven away and forced to flee. Now, why were they driven away and forced to flee?
Because Yahweh went on their side.
That is correct. Yeah, Yahweh was
they
not
reliant on their military.
Protecting them. Yahweh told them right through Shamuel. Here's the deal. When they wanted Shaul to be their king, he says, that by choosing him, they are rejecting me. And this is what they're going to get. War and death. War, death,
yeah,
and death.
Let your army protect you.
Yeah, that's what they chose. Let your army protect. Well, it didn't work out so good. As a result of the presence of the Philistines, that's why they had to flee. And they fell dead. Nafal. They were attacked, conquered, and killed, slain and ritualistically defiled, Cha'al, pierced and treated reprehensibly by a deadly religious force. What a powerful depiction of
that. That doesn't sound all that fun.
No, they were slain and ritualistically defiled. You know, you look at Muslims today, the Manchester bomber. What? Imagine a more disgusting way to defile than to pack a vest with not only explosives but with nails and bolts, so that the explosion would rip apart the flesh of little children. And typically, in fact, in Israel, when these Muslims wear these suicide packs, they actually lace it with rat poison. You know why they put rat poison in their suicide packs?
Poisons you after you have an open wound.
Yeah.
No, that's not quite right. Not quite right. Close, but not quite right. How does rat poison kill?
Hemorrhaging.
Once the nails and the bolts tear your skin apart, the rat poison keeps your blood from coagulating, and therefore you bleed to death.
Yep.
God dang.
Yeah.
Lovely.
Talk about while screaming, Allahu Akbar, my wannabe God is greater than Yahweh. That's a ritualistically defiled way of killing. And they were slain and ritualistically defiled on Mount Gilboa. Gilboa means to seek out and question the means to be rolled away. Then the Philistines overtook Debak steadfastly and closely pursued, stubborn in their desire to plague Shaul, which means question him. Immediately thereafter, and from behind, and also his sons, the Philistines struck down Nakah, beat and afflicted, defeated and destroyed Yonathan, which means Yahweh gives and bestows, yields and designates, and he was yielding control yielding protection to Shaul. Didn't work out very well. Abinadab, which means the father who incites and impels, and Malak Shua, royalty cries out for opulence. Those were the sons of Shaul. The going battle against Shaul caught up with him. He didn't have the protection that Dod had from the 91st Psalm. And the archers lay in wait, turning against him. What does the Quran say about how Muslims should engage in battle against their foes?
Lie in wait.
Specifically, lie in wait.
Oh, yes, you had it. You had it.
Yeah, ambush them. Lie in wait for them. Yeah, exactly. So this is what the Philistine actually depict what would, just like Amalekites do, what Muslims would become. Lie in wait, turning against him. So Shaul said to the one carrying his weapons, because he did not have Yahweh protecting him. He his only defense was his troops, which had failed, and his own weapons. He said, draw your sword and pierce me, lest the uncircumcised will arrive and abuse me. Well, do you find the Dod saying, you know, I think I need to have somebody kill me, otherwise I'm going to be defiled?
No.
No. Do you find Abraham saying, you know, I think you need to kill me, otherwise I'm going to be defiled? Do you find Noah saying that? Do you find Moshe saying that? Do you find Shamuel saying, you know, boy, you better kill me, otherwise I'm going to be killed and defiled? No.
Okay.
But, yeah, Shaul, he was on his own, and it didn't work out. And so the consequence was that he was going to be defiled, and he was going to die. He was going to be abused. But the one carrying his weapons was unwilling, because he was overwhelmed with fear. So Shaul grasped hold of the sword, and he fell, prostrating himself on it. Live by the sword, die by the sword. And did he die by standing upright before the
Philistine? No,
he fell prostrate.
Uh-huh.
You know, his method of death was bowing down. That's telling, isn't it?
Boy,
I guess. You know, yeah, that's how he died.
But I don't think we're going to be seeing Shaul in Yahweh's home.
No,
I don't think so. No, in fact, I'm quite certain that Shaul is with the wannabe Christian prophet, Shaul, Paul, in Sheol. And, by the way, the spelling of Sheol and the spelling of the king's name, Shaul, in Hebrew, how do they differ?
Not by a bit. Not until the Masoretes got involved.
That is correct. Shaul, King Saul, and Sheol, the place of separation from God, are spelled identically. And that's where he's going to be. So not by coincidence. It's not by coincidence that the most deadly plague in all of human history, the wannabe apostle, Shaul, known to Christians as the Apostle Paul, had the same name. This then continues. When the one carrying his weapons saw that Shaul was dead, absent of life and destroyed, as a result of a plague and pandemic disease, he also fell prostrate, prostrating himself upon the weapon and died. So if you were Shaul and you led people away from Yahweh, you added to and took away from Yahweh's Torah, just as Paul did on behalf of Christianity, you're going to die. And if you rely on them, as the weapon bearer did for King Shaul, you're going to die.
You're going to die too.
Yes, exactly, and he died exactly the same way. When the one carrying his weapon saw the Shah was dead, he also fell, prostrating himself on the weapon and died. Shaul died, and his three sons, comprising his entire family, were plagued and died all together at the same time. That's when Yahweh speaks of that fathers corrupt their children. Yeah, generation after generation, this is what he's talking about. His sons were corrupted by the father. They too died. You can have a legacy of life or a legacy of death, depending on how you approach and observe the Torah. When all of the individuals comprising Yisrael who were associated with the cunning and evil plans in the valley observed and perceived this result, they fled, because indeed the plague of death had killed him and his sons. So they had chosen Shaul. Yahweh told them what the consequence was going to be, and when they witnessed the consequence, they knew they were in trouble, that they had brought this upon themselves, and so they fled. They sought to escape. You know, but you can't escape death unless you embrace the covenant and listen to Yahweh. And they had rejected it.
Only one cure for death.
That is correct, the covenant. Then they abandoned their cities and towns for fear of the wild asses terrorizing them, the ear, the wrathful terror and anguish of the donkeys.
Yeah,
by the way, wild ass is a metaphor for Muslims harassing them with their religious compounds. We know when Yahweh said that speaking of Ishmael, who went towards Arabia, and he said specifically that they will be wild asses of men. They will live, their hand will be raised against their brother's hand will be raised against them. Look what's happening in Iraq.
That wasn't hyperbole.
Muslims fighting Muslims. Look what's happening with Saudi Arabia and Yemen. It's Muslims fighting Muslims. Look what's happening in Syria. It's Muslims fighting Muslims. Look what happened in Libya. It's Muslims killing Muslims. Their hand will be raised against their brother. Their brother's hand will be raised against them, and they will live in hostility with the entire world. Describing Islam. And so they, in this case, it was the Jews who became wild asses, then they abandoned their cities and their towns for fear of the wild asses that were terrorizing them, fleeing in haste. So the Philistines, the Philistae, came and occupied them. Oh, wow. Came and occupied them. They were occupiers. So when we tell the mythical people today who have claimed that they're Palestinians and they're nothing just but Arab Muslims, say that the Jews have occupied their land, this is exactly the opposite, that the Philistines occupied Israelite homes. They occupied Israelite land.
I'm afraid it won't make the first page. This report won't make the first page of the news. They're never going to write that.
It won't, because it's true, and political correctness is adversarial to truth. And it came to exist as part of what followed. When the Philistines came as a raiding party to strip the slain, to pierce and wound them, they found Shaul and his sons who had fallen on Mount Gilboa. When the sons of the Philistines, if you will, those who call themselves Palestinians today, the Muslims, when Muhammad went to Yathrib, fled Medina Mecca in shame. And the first thing he does is he decides that he wants to rob a Meccan caravan. This is exactly what he did. He sent a raiding party by night. He stripped the people of their possessions, even their clothing, their armor, their weapons. Even those that he murdered, the slain, Muhammad mutilated. This is Badr. This is exactly what the eighth surah of the Quran depicts. Piercing, mutilating, raiding, and robbing, plunder. The raiding party stripped him, removing his clothing, which is exactly what the Muslims did. And when they sent out and engaged in a terrorist attack, their raiding parties, these robbers, stripped their victim of their clothing. They removed his clothing. I mean, talk about perverted. You know, you're a bunch of thugs. You kill the leader of the people that are living in a neighboring land, and you gloat by stripping the body naked. I mean, why would you even want to be around a corpse? But to go to a corpse and say, you know, I think what I'm going to do is strip it naked. I mean, I can't even fathom the level of depravity here. But these are the Philistines. The raiding party stripped him, removing his clothing. And they lifted up and carried away his head. Do you know of any other religion that actually tells its adherents to cut off people's heads other than Islam? And they do it, don't they?
Not that I can think of.
And here the people that they named themselves after were doing exactly the same thing. They cut off their heads. And they took their heads, holding them up as they were some form of trophy. They stripped him, removed his clothing, and they lifted up and carried away his head and his possessions, sending it throughout the realm of the Philistines, the illegitimate and adversarial foreign invaders who terrorize, taking a circuitous route to proclaim the news to the gods of their religion. Boy, the gods of the Philistines, just like the gods of the Palestinians, love killing. And there's nothing they like more than killing Jews. They haven't changed much in 2000. Well, this is actually 3,000 years ago. Nothing has changed.
Is that why Dode cut off Goliath's head? Because it was their custom, not Yahweh's custom, but their custom to be in your face, you know, after they had threatened and terrorized it.
I think that in the case of Goliath constantly mocked Yahweh. Mm-hmm. And so here's Dode, who loves Yahweh as his father. And here is this uncircumcised, uncouth, vicious, abusive man. And every word out of this man's mouth was to taunt Yahweh. And so my guess is that Dode cut off his head just to say, you know, here's what happens if you taunt Yahweh. Don't do it.
Yeah, well, he cut it off with his own sword, and that was kind of cool, but he didn't. You stick it on a pole and carry it around, so, I mean, it's not the same.
Yeah, and that's what the Philistines are doing. They're sticking it on a pole, they're carrying it around, they're proclaiming the news to their gods, the gods of their religion. And they placed his possessions and weapons in the home of their gods. After sounding a trumpet and clapping, they joined hands in a pledge, violently fastening his skull to the house of Dagon. Yeah, this was a trophy. They were savages. And by the way, with the house of Dagon, does Dagon mean anything to either of you relative to a religion today?
Of course, the Pope's hat. Dagon hat.
I just think of any Christian religion. That's the fish.
Oh yeah, the symbol they put on the back of the car.
Yeah, they're ichthus. They're fish symbol. By the way, you know what the fish symbol that they were using? You know what that fish symbol was actually? would it actually depict it back in the day that the first Christians picked it up? You know what it was?
A female part?
Yeah, a female reproductive organ. And who in particular did the depiction of the female reproduction organ, who was it symbolic of?
I imagine Astarte, don't you think?
Astarte, Queen of Heaven, Mother of God. Absolutely. The Virgin and Child, Madonna, it was who it was indicative of. So when Christians, you know, have their ichthus and they say, oh, you know, sign I'm a Christian, now, that's a sign that you've been poisoned by, the Mother of God, Queen of Heaven.
I happen to love that symbol because anytime I see it on someone's business card or business vehicle, I know not to trust them because that's someone who's going to try and screw me.
That is correct.
Because without a doubt, every small business I've ever seen that has that symbol will do everything they can to screw you over.
Yeah. By the way, the most interesting conversation I ever had with that was with Jerry Falwell, the founder of the Moral Majority Liberty University, Thomas Road Baptist Church, the first of the televangelists, certainly the most famous of the televangelists. He was talking about a project that needed to be done for Thomas Road Baptist Church. And what he said, you know, he said, it's interesting. Anytime that somebody comes to me, it doesn't matter if they're a painter or a carpenter or a contractor, or somebody selling something that I need for my university or church. And if they say, you know, you should give me the contract, I'm a fellow Christian, let's pray over this together. If I have chosen them, they always screw me. They always find a way to take advantage and screw me every time. And if somebody is just rough and grumble and they just say, you know, you need something built, I'm a damn good carpenter. You need something painted, I'm a good painter. If they just come at it as, you want to buy this service, I can provide this service, he says, they do a good job. But the people that cheat me all the time are those who come at me as fellow Christians and want to pray over it. He says, I've never trusted one of them ever since that that was his experience. And, you know, and I look at my business experience, without exception, the most corrupt, the most dishonest, the most manipulative, the greediest, the worst people that I worked with in business were always the most devout Christians. They wanted to have their Bible study. Mm-hmm. They always spoke about how they were devoutly religious and faithful, and they were always the worst scoundrels.
They love it. It's a great way to get their foot in and make you feel like I'm one of you. I'm just like you. We're the same. We can relate.
Yeah.
It's
so
all
they placed his possessions and weapons in the home of their gods, and after sounding a trumpet and clapping, oh boy, let's celebrate death, they joined hands in a pledge, violently fastening his skull to the house of Dagon, the fish god, which was the symbol of fertility. Which, why Easter, which is named after Ishtar, which is the Queen of Heaven and Mother of God, while all the symbols relative to Easter are fertility. You know, a bunny that lays eggs, bunny, reproductive, that's the beast the part of nature that is that reproduces rapidly because they're food, and eggs, the sign of fertility, and then dyed in the colors of spring. It's all a giant fertility cult. That's what Christianity is, the basis of its most famous holiday. So all of Yabesh, Gilead, which means the dried up stubble in Gilead, which is a region east of the Jordan River. By the way, east of the Jordan River, that would be the, be today's Jordan, was occupied by the Ammonites. In Hosea, it's called a place of pollution and inequity. Heard about everything the Philistines had done to Shaul. That's why the Romans picked that name. Therefore, all of the physically strong individuals arose and they carried away the corpse of Shaul and the carcasses of his sons, and they brought them to Jabesh, where they buried their bones beneath the place of the big tree called Allah. Ha, Allah. Just perfect, isn't it?
That's
Allah. Now, Allah is the God of Islam. It means the curse of the deified large oak associated with Esau, who is associated with Ishmael, who represents Muslims. You know, Muslims claim that the covenant was passed on through Ishmael. Muhammad claimed to be a descendant of Ishmael. And as the feminine of El and Elah, Allah, is invocative of the moon god Sin, the symbol of Islam. That's why the Islam has the crescent moon as its symbol, as well as the Quranic goddesses Alat, Manat, and Al-Uzza, representative and reminiscent of Allahu Akbar. Allah is bigger and greater than Yahweh. By the way, Islam is represented by the crescent moon. When Yahweh was describing in the fourth day of creation, there'd be a lesser and a greater light, and that they would be opposites, adversarial, if you will. The greater light was represented by the sun, and therefore the brilliant light of Yosha, Yahweh, and the set apart spirit. The lesser light, which is a pale reflection of it, was the moon. The moon was still necessary because the moon was the means of establishing the moed, the meeting times. But the lesser light, which rules the darkness, was the moon. What symbol did Islam pick?
Of course, the moon guy.
The moon.
Absolutely. Isn't that interesting?
Well, the moon doesn't have any light. It just reflects off, it steals it off of the sun, if you want. If you want to put it
right.
Terms.
Yeah, right. It doesn't create its own light. It's a reflected light. Taking light from someplace else, if you will, and making it look like it's your own.
Yeah.
And they fasted for 7 days. Now, these people, they were political, they were militant, they were religious, they were in opposition to Yahweh, they were dead and dying, and what did they do? They fasted for 7 days. So does this tell us that, boy, we should follow their example and fast too?
Isn't that what they're doing? Ramadan, they fast.
The Ramadan fast is commencing. Oh, you know what the Muslims in Egypt did yesterday to announce the arrival of Ramadan? They murdered I think it was 30 Copt Christians, most of them little children. Nothing says Ramadan
Allah was happy.
More than mass murder. Yes. So therefore, Shaul was plagued and died, placing himself above the relationship for being untrustworthy and unreliable. Shaul was plagued and died, Muth, because he was Ma'al. You know what? If you were to boil it down, you know what the best definition of Ma'al is? Because he was a fraud.
Yeah.
Because he was treacherously deceitful. Ma'al, because he was misleading. Because he transcended beyond the standard, being unfaithful and severing the relationship, committing adultery relative to the covenant. He was Ma'al. That's why he died. Now, isn't Christianity all of those things?
It is.
Yeah, truly is. Treacherously deceitful. Misleading others regarding the agreement. Untrustworthy, unreliable. Placing oneself above the covenant relationship. It's Ma'al.
They deny the covenant relationship. They said the new covenant.
Correct. Yeah, in fact, according to Paul, the covenant that is presented in the Torah, it enslaves. So to be God's son, I guess, is to be a slave if you're a Christian. Whereby he was a fraud, treacherously deceitful and misleading. Well, we got Ma'al again. With regard to Yahweh. Concerning the word of Yahweh, therefore, he was not observant. Moreover, in addition, he approached and consulted with the spirits of the dead, seeking to have a relationship with them. Do you know of a religion today that that honors the spirits of the dead? Canonizes them. Yeah. How about the religion
like
of Christianity?
Yeah,
particularly Roman Catholicism. You know, it wasn't long ago, I think it was like 3 weeks ago, the Pope went to this canonize these little shepherd boys that claimed that they had a vision of the Virgin Mary. And he called them saints. Yeah, the religion of Roman Catholicism is famous for them consulting with the spirits of the dead. Look at, they pray to Mary. They actually evoke
the feast of all saints
from
day.
Dead people. They're saints.
Mm-hmm.
So they are doing the very thing that Yahweh said, for this reason, Saul was plagued and died. And they do it to this day. And he did not seek a relationship with, consult with, or care about Yahweh. Does the Roman Catholic Church Christianity, do they seek a relationship with Yahweh? No.
And his name in their churches.
That's right.
That is correct. They have no relationship with Yahweh. Almost every story that's told in the Torah and the prophets is told not just for us to learn from history, but almost every story that is told as history in the Torah and prophets is also prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
The case of Shaul, that whole story is prophetic of Shaul, the wannabe Christian prophet known as Paul. His given name was Shaul. Every aspect of it mirrors Roman Catholicism and Christianity. They did all of these same things. They were Ma'al, placed themselves above the relationship. They were untrustworthy and unreliable. And they did not seek a relationship with, they did not consult with, they did not care about Yahweh. You know, you want to make a Christian mad? Cite Yahweh's name and his testimony to them. That sounds like your daughter, JB.
The young
yeah, she's cute. Yeah. Very few things more endearing than a little child learning to speak and saying Papa's name, Daddy's name.
Yep.
This is a great thing. It's the ultimate celebration of life. Our way of actually coming to understand and enjoying the covenant. It's, you know, once you have a son or daughter, you really get to see what God had in mind with the covenant, why it's so important. And here's your daughter laughing. You know, what was the first child of the covenant named?
Yishak.
Yeah. When she laughs, does it not bring you pleasure?
Always.
Yeah. Yeah, when she comes to you and says your name, your the daddy father title, it brings you great joy. That's why the difference between Dod and Shaul, the difference between being in the covenant and being a Christian. And when your daughter comes up to you, does she ever get down and bow down and say, "Oh, I worship you"? And I praise you, dad of mine.
Yeah, she sometimes falls just kind of tripping over her own feet, but then she usually pulls herself right back up, or I reach down and help her up.
Yeah. Yeah, when she does, she falls, because they're toddlers, and she falls over her feet, and she falls down. Do you say, that's exactly right, I want you bowing down before me, or do you say, oh, let me help you up?
Oh, you reach down and lift her up. You better yod.
And if she were to fall down again because she thinks that you want her down on her knees, would that not be counterproductive, the antithesis of what you're trying to do?
Yeah.
And so when a Christian falls down on their knees, they're actually counter to God. They're not only
I
lift
her up,
he
I stand her up and hold her hands and walk her around, teaching her how to walk.
Right. Oh, I do it to my granddaughter all the time. Reach down. She reaches up. We grab. She grabs hold of a finger, and that's the way we walk. And any time we're going up and down stairs, or we're going to walk in a street or parking lot, we always hold hands. You know, if there's and if she falls down, I lift her up. It's what we do with children, and that's why the religious approach to God is so much the antithesis of the covenant approach to God, where rather than bowing down before him, God wants us to God lifts us up so that we can stand and walk with him. So it says here, and he did not, speaking of Shaul, this would also be true of the other Shaul, of the founder of the Christian religion, the author of half of the Christian New Testament, Paul, he did not seek a relationship with, consult with, or care about Yahweh. And so he was put to death and destroyed. And therefore, the kingdom turned in the direction of Dod, the beloved son of Ishe, the substance of existence. Ishe means the substance of existence. And so Yahweh said, all right, man chose his way, didn't work. So I'm now going to present my way, which is a father-son relationship with Dod. And it's going to work. What a marvelous contrast in comparison. Now, if you're, of course, a Roman Catholic, this is a pretty dire statement. Now, we go on to, after we've chronicled this story. So this is the story of the religious, the political, the militant approach of man choosing government over the covenant, of man choosing religion over the covenant, of man choosing his way over God's way, and it ends in death. Dod took the opposite approach. Now, this is the story of Dod. We pick this up in 1 Chronicles 15:1, and it reads, he engaged to build houses for himself in the city of Dod, and he firmly established a place for the ark of God to stand, pitching and spreading out a tent for it. So, Dod was closer to Yahweh than any other human in all of history. And so, when Dod went about building homes, did he go about building a home for Yahweh?
No, he's...
You look at all these ancient civilizations, and you look at the Egyptians, you look at the Romans, you look at the Greeks, you look at the Babylonians, you look at the Assyrians, you look at the Aztecs, you look at the Mayans, you look at the Incas. What did they build first? Houses for
temples,
the gods.
And palaces.
Shrines, temples, and temples. Yep, and of course, what did Roman Catholics do when they conquered new territory? They built cathedrals for their god. Yeah, I was just, no. Build a home for yourself. I'm just fine, thank you. You know, I don't want to be imposing.
That is
build
so
a home
killing.
For yourself. Yahweh loved Dod, and what did Dod do? He built homes for himself. Where did he put the Ark of the Covenant? Under a tent. Fine. It's perfect, you know. Open air, colorful, festive, temporary. And the contrast is just perfect. Dod knew that the Ark of the Covenant was important, and so he pitched a tent for it while he was engaged building homes for himself. Then Dod said, no one may approach or carry the Ark of God except the Elohim, because in this they were selected and chosen by Yahweh. to approach, pick up, and carry the Ark of Yahweh, and to render assistance to him forever and ever. So what was Doe's reason for saying, hey, you know, I want to make sure you understand this. There's only one group of people that can lift up and move that Ark. Why?
Because that's what Yahweh said, so that's what he's
saying. There you go. Yahweh said that the Elohim?
This is the deal.
Yeah, are designated to do this. Why did he? What he wanted is a group of people that could amass no property and no wealth, that would be devoted to a singular concept, which is to facilitate people's attendance at and benefit from the Mikre. The Ark of Yahweh is an essential part of the Mikre because it is a mercy seat beside which the Torah instructions were set and in which the Ten Statements resided, that was a mercy seat. It was the seat of honor. And the blood of the sacrificial lamb of Pesach was sprinkled on that mercy seat. And so it was God's way of saying, this is the seat of honor, which I'm going to enable you to sit. And I'm going to enable it through Pesach and Matzah and Bikurim. And Dod recognized that Lowy were chosen to move it, were chosen to lift it up, because they were to help the people understand it, to benefit from it. Now, how long were the Lowy assigned to do this until
Paul came? Forever.
Until Paul came? No. Forever? Forever is a really long time.
It sure is. It's a long time.
Yeah, it really is. Forever. Yeah. Yep, so they were selected and chosen by Yahweh, and it is the Ark of Yahweh. So this Ark of Yahweh, which was comprised by the mercy seat, and it's interesting. When you sit on the mercy seat, what is the back of the mercy seat? You know what the back of the mercy seat is comprised of?
Stones or something?
No. Golden wings.
Oh, well, no, you know, four corners.
Golden wings. Now, why do you think that the back rest of the mercy seat is comprised of golden wings? Do you ever think about why it was comprised that way? Why it was built that way?
No.
What happens when we become part of Yahweh's family and benefit from Pesach and Matzah and are invited to sit in Yahweh's presence on Makudim as his children? What do we gain that we don't have now?
Well, we don't have ability to fly, basically, to go in space and time.
You betcha. You betcha. To travel in space and time. We're going to have what essentially golden wings. We will be like the Malak. We will be able to maneuver very rapidly. As a matter of fact, so rapidly, because with our Malak, with our wings, if you will, wings of light, golden glistening wings, because time as light ceases to be a restricting factor, and distance and speed, covering distance, are always distance over time. When time is essentially irrelevant, when time is all time comprised at any one moment, then speed can't even be calculated. You know, the speed of light is the distance light travels over a period of time. But a light year is a measure of distance. But when time simply exists, as it will, you can be anywhere at any time. And so we're going to be like the Malak. We'll be liberated in time, be able to go anywhere at any moment, and that's the reason the back of the mercy seat, that is the Ark of the Covenant, is wings. So,
well, it will have a limit of you can't go back in time.
Well, you know, the
I mean, you can do a lot of damage back in time. Surely he won't.
You know, Yahweh has not told us that we cannot go back in time. You know, we're only going to have a period of 1,000 years where we'll have the ability to explore the existing universe.
Right.
And Yahweh did not say we can't go back in time. But as light, time is simply going to exist for us. We'll be liberated in the fourth dimension. Once he returns to affirm the covenant, he's going to write his directions, his instructions, his Torah teaching inside of us. So we're going to have a perfect copy of his instructions, of his guidance. So when let's just say that we could go back in time because we might be interested in seeing the dinosaurs, for example.
Yeah.
We're going to have instructions directly from Yahweh that are part of the fabric of our lives that will preclude us from doing something that is damaging or destructive.
Yeah.
So while I'm not
smart enough on the painful consequences to see some things you don't really want to see again, are you?
Yeah, but why would we shortchange Yahweh's instructions such that we would think that we would somehow, that he would cover that and provide instructions as to how to avoid that, and B, when he's going to liberate us in time, why do you think he would put restrictions when all he has to do is convey instructions? And he's already promised to convey the instructions.
Good point.
Now, I'm always uncomfortable when I talk about such things, being liberated in time and us going from three-dimensional constructs to seven, because I always keep in mind that if you were, for example, if Mickey Mouse were really a living creature in the realm of 2D, that Mickey Mouse would have absolutely no capacity to understand Walt Disney's world in 3D, our world. A 2D construct cannot even envision 3D. It's infinitely greater than they are, and they can't envision a three-dimensional realm when they're in Flatland. They could, you know, if Mickey was a living creature, he could model it mathematically, but he could not understand it, could not envision it. So if we're looking at ourselves going from 3D to being liberated in time, 4D, to 5 and 6 and 7 dimensions, we're gaining infinite capacity each step up along the way. And so when you say, okay, we're going to be liberated in time, we have to be pretty careful in saying that, all right, God didn't give us a lot of insights here because we just don't have the capacity at this point. We don't have the perspective in 3D to understand what that means. But we do know what time is and how time as a dimension is. We're stuck in the ordinary flow of it, and that's not going to be true when we are transformed into light. So that is the message here. We've reached the part of the program we're no longer broadcasting. We're just simply recording it at this point. But it's kind of a good stopping point because we're back now to talking about Dote. And so this is going to be a whole long discussion of the difference between, you know, Dote building a home for himself and whether or not it's appropriate to build one for Yahweh. And what we find out, it really isn't. Yahweh doesn't want it. In fact, he's just going to say, hey, you know, the whole time up to this point, did I once say, I want you to build me a house? No. And it's interesting, too, the term that he uses is never temple.
No.
It's home.
His home is always his house.
Right, home. And what is the home for?
The family.
For his family. Right.
Of course.
Exactly.
Tremendous insights. I mean, Yah's character just doesn't come across anywhere else like this.
No, when you're talking about his relationship with Dode, that in contrast to Shaul's lack of a relationship with him, the contrast is just so riveting. It's so insightful.
I'm revisiting a study I did for some other folks a long time ago for Dr. Jeff on praise and worship and prayer.
going through
okay.
every word.
Oh, yeah, you
and
did every
I'm going to send that to you when I'm done and get your two
cents. A couple
cents
of years
on.
Ago. Yeah.
I did, no. But so yeah. I decided this time to do what you often say you do, is go back and start afresh. And I have discovered a lot more that I didn't see before. One of the things, though, in writing the comment
about
that's
an occupational hazard as you study Iowa's word, is that the positive thing is that you learned a lot more. The negative
mm-hmm.
is that the prior work that you did is woefully lacking
and
incomplete.
Yeah. Well, my strength is not writing, translating the way you and James do. But I'm pretty good at analyzing words and taking a big word study on all these different things and say, okay, this is the only thing you can draw a conclusion to, because if you choose this word over that word or this context, you know, that makes Yahweh this way and Yahweh ain't that way. So the hardest thing right at the moment is conveying without getting too wordy on Yahweh is, like you were talking, it was interesting as you were talking with JB on the, with his daughter there. That's the way he is. He's not bowing and scraping. And some of these are fall on your face and put your face in the dirt, prostrate stuff, you know, just like we were talking about show. And I'm going,
do you know why you have a proclivity to understand what words mean?
No. I just desire?
Well, that's without desire, of course, you'll never know. So desire is a given. No.
I want to know.
Words convey visions. A word is used to depict something.
Sure.
And so when you listen to a word, when you hear a word, when you read a word, a vision. A vision of what that represents is mm-hmm. what has promoted your mind. So if I say apple, in your mind you see an apple. If I say lamp, in your mind you envision a lamp. You know, if I say daughter, in your mind you envision a young girl. Looking up to a mother or father.
Mm-hmm.
So words convey images. You're an artist. You see the world through images. Your mind functions by coming to understand the images of things. And so when you look at Hebrew, which was written by connecting pictures, the letters are all pictures of things, they create this vision, this image, which leads to understanding. And when Yahweh says, you know, what I want you to do is shamar, I want you to observe, that's the whole concept of observing, of seeing what things are and understanding what they are based upon what you see. And so you're an artist. You see the world through images, their colors, their shapes, their tones. You know, their relative size, their relationship to other things. You see their colors. You see images, and all words convey images. That image could be of a thing or of an action. And even the actions we envision. Run. Well, we know what that means. Fly. You know, these things convey images. That's how we think. We think in these word images.
Yeah. Well,
so,
I think you've nailed it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's why it's you know, it's a gift. Now, you know, in my case, I'm often accused of making a religion out of words. I love words.
Mm-hmm.
Words are how we think. Yeah. Words are how we think. Yeah. Yahweh loves words. In fact, Yahweh equates himself.
Words.
Yeah, that's how we come to know Yahweh. That's how we see Yahweh, is through His words. And you know, I see words as the greatest gift that has ever been given to humanity. And there's no greater adaptation of that gift than the written word. And it's kind of interesting that there's only one instance in human history, where the written word was conveyed alphabetically. And that's Hebrew. Only done once. And that's why we call it an alphabet, because of the first two letters in the Hebrew alphabet, Aleph and Beth. And so, I don't think there's anything more important than words.
No,
how it communicates with us, how he reveals himself, how he tells us what he is offering. It's how he explains how we capitalize upon it.
It's the only way you can come to know him.
Right, and particularly the written word. And I think that's one of the reasons why, and my friend Roy from Australia is a real stickler on this, and I guess I never really had as full an appreciation of it as I got when I was recently exposed to the Facebook site, because I don't do social media. And I was reading it, and I was just appalled by how poorly the posters at that Facebook site wrote. Their grammar is hellacious. Their spelling is hellacious. Their ability to convey ideas and to be rationally consistent and logical in words is just non-existent. And if you don't have the ability to convey things, because social media is not a discipline where words are conveyed in a disciplined, effective manner, then you are showing an inability to think and an inability to pass on what you may have come to know. It's a tremendous liability, and I think the more we get into texting, the more we get into Twitter and Instagram and social media, the more degradation we do to our ability to communicate in writing. Email, for example, we're continually degrading our ability to communicate in writing, and with that, not only our ability to think, but our ability to pass on knowledge. It's a very serious problem affecting our society.
And we are really breaking down to nothing.
Yeah. Now, you look at it and what you do as an artist. There's not a lot of people that have that skill anymore, that can look at something and see perspective and understand how light is interacting with things, and that can look at something and then can convey that in two dimensions on canvas or on paper or with implements.
You would feel very comfortable in a classroom where I'm showing them the seven fundamentals on how you make an object appear in space, because all the terminology that I use and all the charts I use and have used for years are like you and Roy talking. I'm reminding them this is two-dimensional. And you have a finite number of things that you can do, and all of them come to seven different. And amazingly, there are seven fundamentals, and that's all you got. There aren't any more, and you can't find any more. This is what does it, and it's how you do it. A couple
seven
of them are
fundamentals,
more than emotional stuff.
Yeah, seven fundamentals.
What? Yeah, there's a two of them are
light,
emotional.
Light.
Well, I talk a lot about light and reflected light and warm and cool and high contrast. I mean, value.
Perspective
is
also important too, isn't it?
That's part of what we're putting in a category called space. There's five different ways or six different ways maybe that you can make something appear in space, whether it's be overlapping or using perspective, making things appear large here and small there and soft edges. Cool colors actually recede. It's an optical illusion, but in space I can use the same value and have one cool color next to a warm one. The warm one always is going to jump out. The cool one's going to recede. So I can get
A wall here. I've got a brick wall next to a blue painted surface, and the blue painted surface seems to recede, and the brick wall seems to come at
it. It's an optical illusion. It has to. It's no, you can have a very hot blue, perhaps, a turquoisey type of blue and a very cold, warm, technical warm color, but then you're just playing games. It's really the fact that things have a temperature and they fit in a certain pattern, and they will absolutely recede. I mean, you'll see it in the Renaissance.
Yeah, one of my thoughts has always been
that
if you want to go from knowledge to understanding, one of the most important aspects of this transition from knowledge to understanding is perspective. Where do you stand as you're viewing something? What
Oh, yeah.
What is your vantage point? Right.
If your vantage point is wrong,
you'll never understand it.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, that's the problem, one of the many problems of Christianity. Their vantage point is from the end, and they never really do go all the way to the beginning. But they begin at the end.
Well, if you're going to throw away the Torah, you got some real problems.
Right.
That's what you're asking.
If you want to have a vantage point,
start 2/3 of the way through the book.
Oh, yeah, 85%.
Yeah.
Yeah, look at it from
you'll understand a lot.
Yeah. Don't look at it from the beginning. But it's all one story that begins in Eden. And if you don't understand how the story begins in Eden, you've got no chance of understanding what's going
to
happen when
to Eden.
Returns. It's understanding that the beginning is the end, and the end is the beginning. The Eden is essential for understanding Yahweh's story. So, yeah, perspective is huge. You know, it's also interesting that the rainbow is seven primary colors. Yeah. Roy G. Biv. Seven primary colors. And, of course, it's just light broken down into its seven fundamental colors, pure bands of color. Yeah. Yeah, the seven is emblazoned on so many things, isn't it?
Until I read your book, I never thought about the seven fundamentals and how appropriate that was. You know, we talk about a little bit of industry and something that's not even important anymore in the sense of photography has long since put us out of business. You know, we're the buggy whip in a world that uses cars kind of analogy. But it's really quite I go, wow. Because there aren't any more.
Yeah. If you get
good at these, you're good. That's the secret.
Yeah. Yeah, it's any idiot can take a picture. Now, you know, I'm a photographer. I love photography, and I love to compose a picture, and I love to expose for the shadow, and then to develop it for the highlight, if you will. And I love depth of field, and I love either allowing the time to flow and to create this fluid nature of water, or stopping movement based on shutter speed, and knowing how you can choose the color balance in a picture to make it cooler or warmer. And I love photography. You know, but the interesting thing about photography, if you can't do it, there's always Photoshop.
Well, and now they do it after the fact on the computer.
Right, now there's Photoshop. You know, who needs to be a great photographer? You just Photoshop it.
Yeah. The computer knows much more about that than I do.
Yeah. Yeah. So
It's just not a skillful world anymore, certainly not from the hand, individual standpoint.
And, you know, the skill of an artist is very much like the skill of a translator. There's very specific skill sets that you have to bring to the artistry of translation. So it's very similar. And if you practice it, if you understand the elements that render an effective translation, then you have to apply them, and you have to train yourself in them. You have to engage in them. Got to work at it, practice, if you will.
Oh yeah,
I think it's very similar. Yeah, I think it's very similar, and you can train yourself to be good at it if your perspective is.
Well, you have to put in the time. There's no easy way for that. You know, I can tell you everything in the world, but you won't get it until you do it. Over and over.
Right.
The thing is, the time is enjoyable.
Of course it is.
Yeah, you have
and
to.
And a lot of people think about it. You have to put in the time. Oh, I don't want to do that. But it's good time. You know, it's
right,
not like miserable. Yeah, you know, like translating, it takes time, but it's fun.
Of course. Yes. Yeah, it is.
Absolutely.
It's its own reward. You know, people that would write me and say, you know, I want to thank you for providing these translations. Well, why'd you thank me? I've already been thanked. I've already gotten the benefit. The benefit is doing it. It's reward in and of itself. And that sharing what you have seen, what you have done, what you have learned, actually enhances the reward.
Yeah.
Sharing it doesn't detract from it. It enhances it.
No.
I was going to say, sharing it, then you get the feedback, and then you learn more.
Correct. Yeah, correct. Exactly. Oh, yeah, it reinforces it. But also there's a joy. It's like can go off and earn something at work or accomplish something at work, but you come home and share it with your family. It's much more rewarding.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I remember so many times in life that you see a beautiful sunset, you see a beautiful waterfall, you notice something that is really profound. If you're there by yourself, it's okay. Well, that was interesting. If you're there with someone you care about and you can share it, oh, it's so much more enjoyable.
Indeed.
All right, fellas. That was, speaking of enjoyable, that was enjoyable. We'll pick it up here this time next week.
Yes, indeed. It was a good day.
You know, I'm going to feel a lot better than I could have been tonight than I did this time a week ago.
I know. That's
really good. Like I told you, that was the first Sabbath show I have ever not looked forward to doing.
Yeah. But you know, the most amazing you know, the most amazing part of that whole show, though, was the letter that I received from a woman. I don't think she'll mind me using her name. It's Tricia. And she was one of the people that this former fellow would to use to convince me that, you know, there's nothing wrong with my site. There's nothing wrong with conspiracies. And she was sent off to be used. And by us listening to and standing with Dee and Lisa, and, you know, I had 100 emails that I had positioned that I was going to read that all said the same story. She wrote a letter, and she says, you know, you need to thank them because they saved me. Had it not been for them, I would have been consumed by this. I would have been, the red flags were there. I knew there was something wrong. I couldn't put my finger on it. I was being drawn into it and sucked into it. And by listening to what they had to say, they didn't just save themselves from it. They saved me from it. And there's a lot of me's out there, she said. And a lot of us have been saved from it. And to read a letter like that, I think I shared it with most of you, that the heartfelt letter from Tricia is somebody that that program saved from a life of misuse and abuse.
Absolutely terrible.
You read that, and all of a sudden you see, that was worth doing.
Yeah.
It was worth doing, yeah. Yeah, and you see what
it was one of those shows I did not want to do. I was not looking forward to, but I knew we needed to do it. It had to be done, and it was for the best. But it was not the most enjoyable show to have ever done.
Oh God, it was agonizing. And part of it is this, you know, having to admit we were wrong. Particularly me, I was wrong.
Yeah,
I was wrong. I should have recognized that he was abusive, that he was misleading, and that far more harm was being done than good. After all, I had 100 people tell me that over the years. I should have recognized it. I heard it in my own shows. I had to apologize for it. I was wrong. And
to be right, you got to have a chance to be wrong too. I mean, you walk away from it and
correct.
Go forward.
Correct. That's the lovely thing about Iowa is that. Is that so long as when you actually come to know the truth, so long as you're willing to admit that you were wrong and embrace the truth, then there is no legacy of being wrong. There's no guilt associated with it. There's no remorse associated with it. There's no burden.
It's the appropriate response. Absolutely.
Just stop. Yeah, stop being wrong and accept what's right.
Yeah.
It's liberating. That's why there's no burdens. The whole Torah concept is so liberating.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think we all grow from being able to say, "Oh yeah, that was bad. We were a lot of us were misled. Myself,
made a mistake.
Made a mistake. We had the mistake shown to us. We admitted it, apologized for it, made the announcement.
Did everything we could to correct it.
Did correct it, and that's all that we are asked to do.
Yes, sir.
Because every one of us has been wrong about a lot of things.
Oh, yeah.
And all God says is when you're confronted and I show you that you're wrong, accept
change.
The fact that you were wrong and accept the truth.
Yeah.
Move on to being right. And all
that's
good
all
things
you can
flow
do.
Out of that. That's all you can do, and it's extraordinarily liberating, uplifting to do that. It removes burdens. Rather than burdening you, it removes the burdens. And
yeah.
Trisha's letter was a great example. Yeah. All right, fellas. Thank you. That was fun.
Pleasure.
Oh, yeah.
And we'll be back again.
Talk to you guys again next week.
Yep. Yeah. Thank you.
Hello.
Posting
until we
the observations program on your site. That was
No problem.
That was fun to do, man. I am so glad
to this weekend.
Yeah, that we're also having this opportunity just to show how debilitating fake news and conspiracy can be, how deadly it can be. And that's what our program was on during the observations program, particularly the conspiracy theory and fake news regarding immunizations, vaccines.
Yeah, fun.
Quite an eye-opener. Quite an eye-opener. Don't, do not.
So, say, given your son's field of study, I imagine you have some insight into that one.
You know, my my son views the fake news regarding vaccines as the dumbest thing. Of all of the conspiracies, he says that's the most unforgivable, the one with the greatest negative consequence, and literally the most stupid. He has absolutely no regard whatsoever for those, the anti-vaccine people.
My brother-in-law is a doctor, and his wife is a nurse, and there was a huge falling out in our family with his wife's sister, who's Patty's sister also, who's all into the anti-vaccination thing. And, yeah the doctor and the nurse did not, you know, just kowtow to,
anti-vaccination
thing are evil.
Unbelievably stupid. Unbelievably stupid. Now, that doesn't mean that the person who believes them is incapable of reason. It means that they have forfeited reason to accept their
they've chosen not to use it.
Correct. Yeah, you cannot accept the anti-vaccine point of view without forfeiting reason. I know there's some people that were conspiracy advocates, and when I mock them and said that's really stupid, they're annoyed because they don't think of themselves as stupid. And to be a conspiracy advocate does not mean that you're stupid. What it means is that you've forfeited, as it relates to that aspect of your life, reason. You've chosen not to be reasonable in that regard.
It's a lot like religion. You're either ignorant or you're irrational.
Right.
And ignorance can be fixed.
Right.
Yeah, it's the same thing with the conspiracy theories. If you're believing a conspiracy theory, you know, especially these things like vaccines, you know, you're either ignorant of the facts or you're completely irrational.
Right.
Now, if you're ignorant of the facts,
so that
you can work with that.
Right. Right. And if you're once you reject religion, you have now the capacity to shed ignorance and to be rational, to know and to reason. So it's not that the religious person is incapable of being rational. It's not that they are stupid. They're only stupid as it relates to their unwillingness to use evidence and reason to examine their religion. The same thing is true with the conspiracy, that while you are embracing them, you are being stupid. Now, you may or may not be capable of growing past that. But you're never going to grow past it so long as you embrace these delusional ideas. Your life can't, that can't be your perspective. It can't be your focus. God says if it is your focus, if advocating these conspiracies part of what you are and what you do, and it's part of those that you associate with, he says it will make you psychotic. It will make you delusional. It will destroy you. I think he knows what he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Usually so that does.
That was the program we did today, as we focused on the vaccine conspiracy. It was it's stunningly enlightening when you think about it. All right. Well, good night. Happy Shabbat.
Happy Shabbat.
Yes.
Yeah. Happy Shabuah Shabbat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Shabbat's coming next week, right?
Next week.
See you guys next week.
Yeah. All right.
Bye.
Good night.
Night, guys.